The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample.
And me, Hannah Devlin.
Coming up on the show, as world powers met this week with the aim of reaching a deal with Iran to curb the country's nuclear activities, we talked to two of the UK's experts on the verification of nuclear treaties. UN Nuclear Testing Inspector George Tuckwell and Professor Wynne Bowen, Head of Defence Studies at King's College, will be telling us about the challenge posed by Iran, about the job of an on-site nuclear testing inspector, and about how nuclear tests can be detected remotely by the international community. Plus, we'll be looking at some of the news from this week, the grim effects of poverty on the brain, and the longest overseas journey for any land bird. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Foreign ministers from the US, UK, France, China, Russia, and Germany were locked in intense negotiations with Iran this week in Lausanne, seeking to reach a nuclear deal that would prevent Iran from producing nuclear weapons. As we are recording, discussions are still underway, and it is likely to be June before the details are finalised. One man who can throw some light on the issues is Professor Wynne Bowen, Head of Defence Studies at King's College, and a former UN weapons inspector in Iraq from 1997 to 1998. Also joining us is George Tuckwell, a surrogate UN nuclear testing inspector and director of geophysics at RSK, an environment consultancy. George is one of the 200 global inspectors that the UN is recruiting and training to enforce its comprehensive test ban treaty, which will make illegal the nuclear tests needed to develop a bomb. Welcome to you both. Wynne, can I start with you, just for the very basics? Can you set out what we know about Iran's nuclear ambitions?
So the current Iranian nuclear crisis has been going on now for the best part of 12 years, since around about 2003. And Iran claims that it only has civil designs behind its program, but because of the dual-use nature of the technology, that it can be applied to military purposes also. There has been this concern that Iran may have ulterior motives. And I think a lot of the reason for that concern is that many aspects of the Iranian program have been developed clandestinely. There have been secret facilities. There's not a huge economic rationale for some of the work that it's been doing on uranium enrichment. And also evidence has come out that there have been military-specific bits of research done in the country on things like weaponization implosion design for a nuclear device. So the crisis has been going on for, as I said, about 13 years or so, and this is just the current episode in the crisis. If you jump back all the way back to 2004, the Iranians agreed to suspend enrichment back then with the EU. But since then, we've seen a lot of water under the bridge. We've seen the UN Security Council resolutions imposed on Iran for its non-compliance with IAEA safeguards. And that brings us right up to the present day today. And the current concerns are focused really still on the enrichment and what is that meant for, and trying to constrain that as much as possible to prevent a rapid breakout from the non-proliferation treaty if Iran chose to do so. And also on the plutonium side, there's a concern over heavy water reactor at Iraq, the IR-40, again, which is part of the negotiations that are ongoing.
Can you just crystallise, though, what these negotiations are about? We have the P5 plus one on one side, Iran on the other. What does P5 plus one want? And what does Iran want? I mean, just what are these issues actually about, the negotiations? What are people going for?
So the Iranians claim to have a civil nuclear program. They claim not to have any military intent, that nuclear weapons play no sort of role in their strategic doctrine. Again, that's open to debate, I think. My argument would be that Iran is pursuing a hedging strategy, which is developing the components of a nuclear program, the uranium enrichment aspects, weaponization aspects, not to go for a weapon necessarily, but to have the option to do so at some point down the line. I think the outside world also tends to think that, and I think the P5 plus one, through their attempts to solidify an agreement around a small latent capability, they are implicitly recognizing that.
Could I just come in with a basic science question? What distinguishes the kind of enrichment program you'd need for a civilian nuclear capacity and making a bomb?
Okay, if I'm going to be really smart, I'd say intention, because the technology is dual use and in this case is directly relevant. I mean, there would be changes that you would make. Clearly, you'd have to enrich U-235 isotope of uranium to a much higher level for weapons purposes compared to the 3-5% you may need for a civil nuclear program. There are ways to configure cascades of centrifuges. Clearly, that would be more will be better designed, I think, for a weapons program. But yeah, so there are differences, but really there's no fundamental difference.
So ultimately, the same centrifuge could make uranium Absolutely. For a power station and uranium for a bomb.
Absolutely. Yeah, and if you look at nuclear programs in history generally, there's been a big interplay between civil nuclear programs and military programs, you know, the UK being a good example.
We hear a lot about breakout, and I wonder if you can explain what that phrase means and what this one-year timeline seems to be, what the origins of that one-year timeline seems to be that people are going for. And is that really what these negotiations are all about?
I think, you know, the breakout thing has come to center stage in the last 12 to 24 months since the new administration came to power in Tehran. And so breakout really is a concept related to preventing a country that's a non-nuclear weapon state signatory to the non-proliferation treaty deciding to make a break out of the treaty and to physically acquire weapons in short order. So the discussions at the moment and the analysis that seems to be going on is focusing on a 12-month breakout timeline, and to get the verification processes and procedures in place to give enough warning that Iran is looking to break out. And I think that's part of the challenge over this agreement that they're seeking to pursue, is that you need a significant level of intrusiveness of a verification protocol to give that confidence that you'd be able to detect a breakout in a timely fashion.
Is that 12-month timescale mostly picked based on the amount of time you'd need to get inspectors in the country and come to agreements on things like that? Or is it more about how long it would actually take, given Iran's centrifuges at the moment?
I think it is about, you know, the physical aspect. How quickly could they get their current uranium UF6 stocks into the centrifuges, you know, cycle them up to the right levels of weapons grade, and how long it will take to produce a device? And I think that it's focused around that, but there are multiple different centers sort of producing different calculations of that. Different governments have different processes for establishing that too. And, you know, in a realistic breakout scenario, if I were Iran, I would be thinking I wouldn't want to break out with one weapon. You want to break out with several. And then this comes back to the whole issue of verification, is that the inspectors who are on the ground there, they're on the ground there now, are only inspecting facilities that have been declared. And Iran has a long history of secretly developing facilities and then being outed. So there is this underlying concern, I think, that there may be secret facilities in Iran that we don't know about, which could have small numbers, 3,000 or so centrifuges that could be used to develop uranium beyond the inspector's purview. You know, this is what happened very much in Iraq in the 1980s. So there's a lot of history, a lot of baggage taken from other contexts, and you know that's helping people interpret what we may have to worry about in Iran.
I'm still missing the point on why the community is happy with a year, whereas they're not happy with a shorter period of time. I mean, what does a year give the outside world that 6 months doesn't give them?
I think really, I mean, taking this in a concise way, I think 12 months basically gives you enough time to understand that something's happening that you don't want to happen. There's enough time for diplomacy, and then there's enough time to use military force to then, you know, knock out the facilities in question. You know, that's my take on it.
And is that what would, is there appetite for that? If you know, casting ahead, horizon scanning, if Iran is found to be very close, is there an appetite for that?
I don't believe there's much of an appetite at all for that. And I think this is why where we are with the negotiations at the moment. There's no appetite, I don't think, for that in Western Europe, clearly, the United States in particular. But, you know, Obama has drawn I know Obama's red lines are not necessarily the best to go by, but Obama has drawn a red line at an Iranian nuclear weapon. But I think the key with the Iranian issue is that I don't expect Iran to go in developing nuclear weapons anytime soon, if ever. What they're doing is having this latent deterrent capability, which is the ability to break out, and everyone knows that. And if you've seen recent comments by senior Saudi officials, they very much recognize that. You know, they've said that whatever agreement is reached with Iran, we want the same. Mm. So you have this, people talk about a proliferation cascade in the Middle East where Iran gets nuclear weapons than Saudi Arabia. I think what we should be thinking about is a hedging cascade, which, you know, is better than nuclear weapons proliferation cascade, but it is on the way there potentially. So if we do see the strategic situation change in the future, then those countries will be much closer to be able to make a decision to go for weapons.
And does Iran and maybe some of these other countries, do they have a good case that some of the conditions being imposed is genuinely limiting their abilities to use nuclear power for civilian purposes?
I don't think Iran is the best example of having a good case for this, because it went out very purposefully to develop capability beyond the purview of the IAEA prior to 2002. I think some of the justifications that it has been making, I mean, it's got very ambitious plans for its nuclear power program in the future, but the scale and the pace of its enrichment program does not make sense, given that the expansion of its power program is a long, long way off, and its existing reactor, the power reactor Bushehr, is fueled by Russian fuel, which then is going to get repatriated. So at the moment, the Iranians aren't even fueling their own power reactor, and to set up the next power reactor, it takes at least 10, 12 years, the very minimum. Bushehr took much longer than that to set up. So there's these nagging questions, I think, about the rationale.
And are there other countries with legitimate nuclear aims which are being hampered by some of these?
Everyone is looking at Iran as a test case in many different ways. And Iran diplomatically has been very adept at using the rights under the Non-Proliferation Treaty to access to civil nuclear technology to its benefit. And there are many other countries out there, Brazil, Argentina, they've got, very active nuclear programs, South Korea, etc. And all of these countries are looking at what happens in this context, because it will have an impact on civil uses in the future in other contexts where there are no concerns about security issues.
Can we come to the sort of science and engineering of some of this on the ground? If there is a deal which says Iran is limited to 6,000 centrifuges or whatever the number may be, 10,000, what have you, whatever it is that is taken to give them this one-year breakout time, what does that mean doing on the ground? Does this mean actually dismantling centrifuges? Does it mean just making them, reconfiguring them? Or how much of a kind of a destruction of their sort of capabilities, which presumably will play into how willing they are to accept it, what would they have to do, and how do you actually police that?
I think that question really gets to the difficulties, I think, of the P5 plus one and Iran actually coming to an agreement, because it's the devil is really in the details. So, Iran has many more than 6,000 centrifuges at the moment at both its Natanz plants and at the Fordow site. And there is clearly negotiation going on about what is going to be allowed to be in place at the different sites. So I think it would be 6,000 at the Natanz plant, probably some at the Fordow plant, possibly not doing uranium enrichment, but being used for other purposes. So, yes, I mean, it'll mean disassembly, which would be done under verification, so with inspectors there. I don't know the answer to the question of, do they then destroy these things, or do they just put these things into storage under verification again? This is the detail which I'm not party to, but it's probably what's bedeviling the negotiations.
And verification becomes a daily task, a weekly task, and you have to have access whenever you like?
Absolutely. Well, there's something called the Additional Protocol, which came out of the Iraq inspection failures in the 1980s over the nuclear program. And a lot of states have signed up to this Additional Protocol in addition to their comprehensive safeguards agreements on nuclear, which allows the IAEA to have much greater access rights in the country, much greater freedom to roam around and inspect different facilities. Iran has not sort of signed up and ratified that yet, and that'll be part of the deal. It'll be Additional Protocol or potentially Additional Protocol Plus, because even the Additional Protocol has limitations to it. That, in the end, I think, is going to be the challenge. It's about access in the end, and it's about access on the terms of the inspectors, not so much on the terms of the inspected party. And that's, again, the difficulty, I think, is in the negotiations, is the Iranians probably not wanting to agree to significant intrusiveness beyond which they already have.
What are they looking to get out of it?
The Iranians clearly want the sanctions removed. Mm-hmm. They clearly want to normalize relations. The negotiations have been supported by the Supreme Leader, who's been very supportive of the President. So clearly, they want to change Iran's relationship with the outside world. I think underlying that is that there's a lot to... I think key parts of this are about regime survival and long-term survival of the regime, and recognizing that it has to change tack in certain areas, and that actually, if they don't get something out of these negotiations and we revert to where we were before 2 years ago or so, then, you know, Iran is going to be in a situation where it may face military action. You know, not that I don't think anybody wants to participate in that, given what's going on in the region already.
George, we haven't brought you in yet, and I apologise for that, but let's talk about what happens in the worst case scenario. Maybe it's not the worst case scenario, but certainly an escalation of this would be that if Iran or even some other country progresses to the point of having a nuclear bomb, how do you then look at, try and understand whether any country has done a covert nuclear test?
So undertaking a test is a necessary part of developing a weapon, from having enriched the uranium to the point where it's of weapons grade. You need to test it to establish that you've got the technology and that technology works. Now, when you let a bomb of that size off, then a number of things happen. If it's in the atmosphere, you get a very loud noise. If it's in the ocean, you get very loud noise going through the ocean. If it's underground, then you've got a lot of seismic waves, equivalent in magnitude that you would to a reasonable sized earthquake. And of course, with a nuclear weapon, you get a lot of radiation generated as well. So there are two aspects to detecting whether or not a clandestine test has been undertaken. One is a global monitoring system to listen for those sound waves and for those seismic waves, and also to try and sniff out any radioactive release associated with the test. And then if a suspicious event is identified by that global monitoring system, is then to actually go to the location that that monitoring system identifies of that suspicious event and make much more detailed investigations and measurements on the ground to try and pick up factual evidence of whether or not a test has been undertaken.
And are those monitoring systems in place, and are they sensitive enough and in the right sort of numbers of sensors around the right kind of places to pick up tests in Iranian territory in that area?
Yes, so there's, when the entire global system is complete, there'll be 321 separate stations as evenly spread around the globe as geography allows you to do. And so certainly around the Iranian area and around every country in effect, there is a sufficient density of monitoring stations to be able to pick things up. And it's a requirement under the treaty that the international monitoring system is able to identify the location of a test to within 1,000 square kilometres. And in the majority of the world, it can identify and locate an event to a better accuracy than that. So currently, there's about 280 stations up and running, and plans are in place to complete the monitoring system and build and install the others.
What gives you your best information? Is it the seismic waves, and does that allow you to kind of triangulate, or what is the best?
Yeah, so the best location information comes from seismics. If we assume that we're dealing with an underground nuclear test, which is the most likely scenario if someone's trying to do a test and get away with it, then it's the seismic waves which allow you to get that location. And it, in the very simple sense, yes, it's a triangulation. It's the what time do the waves, those seismic waves, arrive at different monitoring stations around the globe, and you triangulate back to the position, and you get an ellipse of probability which gives you that location. There are other aspects to those waves that you would look at to distinguish it from a naturally occurring earthquake. One characteristic of an explosion is that it pushes outwards in all directions, whereas an earthquake generates motion that goes one way on one side and the other way on the other side. And looking at whether the ground is being pushed or pulled as it arrives at the monitoring station is one way to distinguish an explosion from one of the 14,000 or so naturally occurring earthquakes of similar magnitudes that would occur each year.
Given that most of these tests are probably going to be carried out in secret if anyone tries to do one, how confident are we that we're picking up all these events?
The detection capability is very well known. It's carefully characterised. When the stations are installed, they're tested so that we know what their detection limits are against background noise, and that gives us a detectability map for the globe to ensure that it's sufficient to identify a bomb, say, of a kiloton, I think is the typical threshold that's talked about. So a kiloton or more sized explosion anywhere in the Earth to an accuracy, as I said, of at least 1,000 square kilometres for that location. The three tests that North Korea have undertaken, all three were detected by the International Monitoring System for seismics. The first test and the third test were also detected for radionuclide emissions as well. So again, a very clear verification that that monitoring system is effective.
Is there anything particular about the Iranian geology that acts in their favour or complicates matters?
Geology is one of the biggest challenges. What you're trying to achieve, if you're going to seek to get away with this is complete containment of all that radioactive material. You may be able to explain away the seismic signal, but you can't explain away these indicative radionuclide signatures of a nuclear explosion. So you need to keep those within the ground, and the geology is your barrier between the site of the explosion and the surface where it would then be detectable. So there are a variety of challenges. There's a particular challenge of the right type of rock, and specifically you need to avoid any rocks with a lot of calcium in them, because that generates argon as a noble gas, argon-37, which is absolutely indicative of a nuclear explosion. It's not generated in any quantity any other way. So if you see that, then it's clear what's happened. So rocks like chalk and limestone and anything with a lot of calcite mineral in are a bit of a no-no. And Iran's got a lot of that in various places, but they also have a lot of other geological units which are much more suitable. Massive crystalline rocks of old crustal material or granite igneous rocks, which are entirely suitable. And most countries in the world have a variety of geology which they can choose from.
So assuming that all our detectors work effectively and we get a seismic signal and pick up some radiation that looks like a nuclear test, where do you go from there? How do you verify it?
So if there's been a suspicious event, then under the treaty, under the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, once that comes into force, then one state can accuse another state of undertaking a test. And that might then trigger an on-site inspection, which would be a team of 40 inspectors which would go to that location on the ground and try and collect additional data which would shed light on whether or not an underground nuclear test has taken place. Now, the key thing is to get there very quickly. There are some signatures of an underground test that would decay extremely quickly. So, for example, you've generated a large cavity, albeit somewhere between 500 and 1500 metres underground. Over time, that's gradually going to collapse, and that in itself will generate very small seismic signals. So you'd go to the area, you'd deploy a whole series of extremely sensitive seismic measurement instruments, and you'd listen for earthquakes down to a magnitude of -2 on the magnitude scale. So extremely small things. But these decay away very quickly. They decay away in a matter of days, weeks at most. There's also some radionuclide signals which you'd want to get on the ground quickly to try and measure. But there are some other longer-lived isotopes which will be around for a number of months. So typically you would to try and detect those seismic signals, you would of course take a look around. It's a major engineering feat to emplace a test underground. There'd be earth movements, there'd be tunnelling or large-scale drilling operations. Now, those might have been cleared away, but the modifications that those have made to the ground and the infrastructure that you would need around them, there would be traces of those. They might be visible traces or they might be invisible traces that we would use some of the geophysical technologies that we typically use for mapping any bit of ground, whether it's for the route of HS2 or a new power station. Those same techniques will detect variations in the shallow ground associated with that infrastructure, which was associated with that test. All of this information is circumstantial, unless you can measure one of the what we call the smoking gun radionuclides, which are indicative of an underground nuclear test. And those are the ones which we're really targeting. But to get to those, you need to be on the ground in the right place at the location where those might be venting out of the ground. And that's where we get into the search logic and how you go about searching the area.
I think you said that the detectors give you 1,000 square kilometre accuracy of where the test might have been carried out. How do you go about narrowing that area down or searching it?
Well, there isn't time to go everywhere in that area and to make all the measurements that you would like at every location. So you need some search logic, some way of prioritising one area over another. And there's different ways that you can do that, but the difficulty is in this, rather than just trying to find something which may be lost, you're trying to find something which may be hidden. So you can't use, say, a Bayesian probability map of what geology would be most suitable, and okay, well, it'd be harder to do it under a major population centre, so we'll put those as lower probabilities and areas in the middle of nowhere as higher probabilities and generate that map and then target your search that way, because the other side would have done exactly the same thing. They might have had a team of experts creating exactly the same probability map, and then they would undertake the test, of course, in a place where you're not going to have time to look because you'll have looked in all the high probability places. So we need to develop a logic which is not published in advance. It's reacting very much to the information that you gather on site and the information that's been gathered by the international monitoring system, and reacting to those bits of information with no preconceived ideas about what might be where. And that, for scientific experts to go into an inspection on site, armed with all their expertise and their experience of what they've seen before, and to throw all that away and try and be completely objective, is quite a psychological feat. Experts are, the more expert you are, if you like, the more biased you are, and the more likely you are to recognise things because they're things you've seen before. So the easiest way to fool an expert is to show them something they haven't seen before. And training the experts to look for just the bare facts and what might they mean objectively is quite a tough thing to do. And then you add on the fact that you've only got 40 people, which isn't as much as you would certainly like, and it's an international team, so you've got the language barriers and you've got a number of different expertise altogether: radionuclides, seismologists, other geophysicists, logisticians, and the diplomats, which are going to be doing the negotiation on the ground. You've got a lot to contend with there.
You're meeting with colleagues from the US, China, possibly even Iran, for a workshop in Tel Aviv in a couple of weeks. And I'm interested in what the dynamic is there. Do you all feel like you're on the same team as scientists, or are you quite aware of the political tensions that are around these negotiations when you meet up to discuss monitoring programmes?
You are aware of the political context, inevitably, but it's the intention of things like the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty and our role as scientists within it, is that our role there is very apolitical. And so we're there to gather scientific facts, to develop the methods to gather those facts and how best to report them and how best to organise and run on-site inspections. So in that sense, you're allowed as a scientist to step away from the politics of it and relate to the technologists and the scientists on that level. You can't ignore the politics, it's inevitably there. And when you get into negotiations on what techniques you might be able to use in what circumstances and at what point in an on-site inspection, for example, then the politics inevitably come into it. But for the most part, we try and avoid those and concentrate on our first love.
Wynne, just coming back to you, you talked about how Iran is hedging in its negotiations here. Is this something that we've seen before, that we always see in this kind of situation? Is it something that other countries will learn from, essentially?
Yeah, I think there are certainly countries that will be learning from Iranian behaviour. And Iran, in many respects, I think, has looked at other examples, past and present. Japan is quite often singled out as a country that is hedging its nuclear bets. It has looked at the military option in the nuclear area in the past. Discussions in Japanese politics now, you know, the issue of nuclear weapons acquisition does come up quite regularly, taken against the backdrop of a vast civil nuclear program that the Japanese have. The fact that it has a lot of separated plutonium, stockpile of plutonium. It has a satellite launch program which is based on solid fuel, not liquid fuel, so therefore could make the basis of an intermediate range ballistic missile if need be. The difference between Iran and Japan clearly is that the Japanese have not been found to have violated any of their commitments under their safeguards agreement, where Iran has. So the analogy just goes, it doesn't go all the way. So this hedging thing is, I think, is likely to, I think, define the future challenges to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, that the world is going to see an increasing number of countries that will have the potential, the latent technical potential, to develop weapons, not necessarily the intention to do so. But the more countries that have that potential, the greater the potential, therefore, for nuclear proliferation. And the Iranian example really sort of encapsulates that challenge, I think.
Do any of these countries ever play the sort of very...
The Guardian.
...naive card, for me at least, which is that, why shouldn't we have nuclear weapons? You lot have got them.
Well, if we just go to the basic fact that most countries in the world have signed up to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and in that treaty there are five illegal weapon states, the P5, and then there are the rest have signed up as non-nuclear weapon states. So if those countries that have signed up as non-nuclear weapon states are contemplating nuclear weapons acquisition, then what they should do is use Article 10 and withdraw from the treaty, citing extraordinary circumstances, and go that way. I mean, North Korea has done that, but before exiting the treaty had completely violated the treaty and its spirit, and the letter of the treaty. And I think that's the difference between hedging and breakout, full breakout.
But do countries still see a political kind of, maybe not an imperative, but a desire that if you have this, it gives you extra clout that you may not have had, you are maybe less threatened by other nuclear countries?
Yeah, no, I think so. I think undoubtedly you think of a country like Iran, it very much does see having a complete nuclear fuel cycle, civil or otherwise, as something of a latent deterrent. You know, and also it gets into questions of prestige and influence too. So I think there's no doubt about that.
Just before we wrap this up, I wanted to ask a bit about the negotiating procedure that happens around these things, and it's happening at the moment in Lausanne. We always see these negotiations going on late into the night, sometimes early hours of the morning, and it gives you the flavour from an outsider that, you know, you shouldn't be making these decisions when you're exhausted and you've after you've gone through this really intensive, grueling process. Presumably, it's not actually happening like that. Presumably these teams change over, do they? And there is a way of keeping people fresh and yet informed during the negotiations. How does it all work to make sure that people aren't just starving in need of biscuits and sleep?
Well, I haven't been involved in these things myself, right? So I should say that first. But I think we shouldn't underestimate the amount of work that's gone into this before the getting to Lausanne, in terms of the various national teams working together. And also these national teams can be quite sizable too. So, you know, it's the people we tend to see are the sort of the higher the senior figures, you know, the foreign secretaries, you know, secretaries of energy from the United States, etc. And these guys clearly are going to be tired, but they're going to be very well supported, and they have their key talking points. So I don't see this as, you know, an unnatural thing in international politics. You know, it's just like any other negotiation would be. Yes, they can get tired doing it, but they clearly have had some good rest last night, and hopefully we'll crack on today.
Very finally, I just wanted to get each of you to give your thoughts on what do you see happening? What's your best guess of where this will be when they wrap up?
So I think we'll see some sort of agreement this week. It won't have all the detail in it, probably. And then the detail will have to be addressed by the end of June. I think we will see an agreement because I think the key parties involved, notably the United States and Iran, need to have something. Obama needs to have an Iran legacy. The Iranians need to have sanctions relief and to move forward. And I think basically, you know, that the prospect of not having an agreement is too dire. And I think all sides actually recognize that.
George?
I think that's right. The devil in the detail and the technical detail is to come between now and June. I would hope that there would be a framework agreement that would lead to that. What will be interesting to see is if there's anything that comes out of it relating to nuclear weapons testing and the ratification of the Test Ban Treaty.
Professor Wim Bowen and George Tuckwell, thank you both very much.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Now, coming to some of the science stories that have been in the news this week. Ian, what have you been writing about?
One of the stories I did in the week was about a study of more than 1,000 children that some researchers at Columbia University and some other guys in California had done, where they were trying to find out what the impact of, we'll call it low social economic status, basically means being poor, having low levels of education, what effect that has on children's brains. And there's a lot of work that's already showed that children born to the sort of poorest families can do worse on cognitive skills, on cognitive tests and things like that. And they're trying to sort of get to the bottom of what's really going on here. Why would that necessarily be the case? I think what this study does is it brings to the whole kind of discussion that there are actually physical changes going on in the brain. Now, it's a bit early to say whether this is really causative, but they did try and take into account the kind of genetic factors that might be at play here. Now, what they found was that in the children from the really poorest end of the scale, end of the of families, they had a smaller cortical surface area. So this the cerebral cortex, that was the surface area of that was smaller, slightly smaller on average in the children at the very sort of the lowest end, the very poorest end of the children they looked at, than the very the children from the much more sort of affluent families. And what they're trying to say is that these may be the physical changes which are resulting in the kinds of differences we see in how well these kids perform. Now, what is the point of doing this? Well, if you're going to try and address these issues, if you're going to try and improve the lot of these kids, what do you do? Because you're not going to solve poverty overnight. But if you can somehow tease out what exactly is responsible for the lion's share of the problem, then maybe you can start doing some smart interventions. So maybe this is all about these children not being spoken to enough with the right kind of language. Maybe it's purely about the parents working so many jobs and so many hours that they don't have enough sort of quality time with their children to give them, or to give them a really kind of enriched environment, you know, which can obviously help with brain development. And maybe this means that you need to come in actually with more sort of social benefit type interventions. And that's one thing that these researchers are doing, which is quite an interesting one, I think, is they're going to do a big randomized control trial of a sort of a representative group of Americans and say, okay, we're going to recruit mothers from the lowest socioeconomic class in the States, and we're going to randomize half of them to a group that gets a big monthly payment, and the other half will get a very small monthly payment. And then in the long term, look at how their children fare and see if this has any effects. Now, one thing the researchers were really keen to point out was that these differences you see in the kids' brains, it's not like they're set in stone. It's like that's how they're born, that's how they are when they were measured. But it doesn't mean that environmental changes, putting them into better situations, having them in more sort of enriched environments isn't going to help those children. It very probably will.
I'm intrigued about how big these differences are. So if your parents earn 10 grand more than my parents, say, are you likely to have a bigger brain?
So from the figures in the study, if you look at the families where their income was greater than $150,000, their children on average had a 6% larger cortical surface area if you compare those with the children of families earning less than $25,000. Now, the effects of this are really concentrated down at the lower end of the income scale. So if you're in a sort of reasonably well-off family, an extra 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 pounds a year isn't going to make any difference to the size of your brain. Where you see the differences is at the very, very low end of the scale. If you start giving those people more money, then you do start to see, by the looks of things, that you would see decent changes in their brains. And some of that may be to do with just enough money to alleviate the stress of how you're going to get by that month, or some kind of job security. So stress may be a major factor in what's coming into play here. But Hannah, what was the story that you picked out this week?
I've been writing about a tiny North American songbird called the Black Pole Warbler, which scientists have just discovered takes the longest overseas migration route for any land bird. So they've discovered that it travels about 1,500 miles non-stop across the Atlantic in the autumn when it migrates south. The amazing thing about this is that if this bird were to drop into the water, it would be fatal for it. So it has to make the journey non-stop, which takes about 2 or 3 days. And it just is one of those amazing feats of nature that this tiny, unremarkable bird, which the scientist I spoke to actually said to me that there's nothing particularly athletic about it when you look at it, that it's able to achieve this incredible feat.
So Hannah, how do they actually find out that this bird actually does this migration?
So they've suspected that it was making a overseas migration for a while, partly because during stormy weather in the Atlantic, black pole warblers were spotted on boats. And the other factor was that they seem to be putting on an awful lot of weight in the autumn. So these birds are tiny. They weigh 12 grams, about the same as a £2 coin. And they were almost doubling in size, some of them, when it got to the autumn, which suggested they were preparing for a really big journey overhead. The problem was that because they're so small, there wasn't any kind of geolocating tracking device that they could attach to them until now. So it was only a couple of years ago that they made something small enough that weighed just half a gram that they could attach onto the back of the bird and record ambient light levels and times, which allowed them to work out the routes that the bird were taking.
So presumably not all these birds make it. Putting a backpack on them, does that help their chances?
Well, it's interesting you ask that. The scientists told me that perhaps only about half of the birds make it, and said that they did worry that just adding this extra factor against them could stop them making it back. But they did find that at least some of them made it back, partly because the tracking devices are so small, they can't transmit data. So to check where they'd gone, they had to actually retrieve them from the birds when they came back the following year. And I think out of 40 birds, at least 5 of them, which they managed to catch in the forest, made it back.
So some may have died, but they died for science. I'll leave it there. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to George Tuckwell, Professor Wimburn and Hannah Devlin. From me and all the science team, thanks for listening.